So let me turn first to Bakan Sachiolu. Did I say that correctly? Institute for European Integration Research, Vienna. The title is The EU's Rhetorical Entrapment in Enlargement Reconsidered. Why hasn't it worked in the Turkish case? Bakan.
Thank you. Okay, so it's late in the day, and we should make an extra effort to keep our presentations to 15 minutes, I think. Well, I'm going to start by giving you a very short overview of the paper and walk you through the puzzle, the research question, the argument, and the method that guide the paper, and then I'll fill you in on the details on each of these things. So the paper analyzes the EU's decision regarding membership negotiations with Turkey, which happened at the December 2004 Brussels summit. So the decision was that the EU would launch negotiations with Turkey, and that had long been awaited by the Turkish government, as you may already know. So that was good news, but it also decided on very tough and unprecedented even negotiation terms. So for instance, the Brussels Council ruled that membership may not happen at all since, quote, negotiations are an open-ended process and that Turkey could be, quote, fully anchored in the European structures through the strongest possible bond. And the Council also noted that Turkey's membership, if it were to happen, could be subject to certain special terms, such as, for instance, permanent safeguard clauses and long transitional periods in key areas of the acquis, like the freedom of movement of persons, structural policies, or agriculture. So these accession terms that were decided in Brussels are puzzling, and that is precisely why I have chosen to write this paper. They are a puzzle that demands explanation because prior to this summit, Turkish political actors intensively lobbied in Europe and they engaged in rhetorical argumentation to persuade the EU folks not to adopt such tough conditions in Brussels. They argued that negotiations should not only be launched, but they should also be launched on fair terms. That is to say, terms that A, would clearly commit the EU to Turkey's full membership and not just any other status short of that, like, for instance, privileged partnership, and B, would exclude any special conditions, such as the permanent safeguard clauses and the like, which could potentially reduce Turkey's status to that of a second-class EU member state. And the actors embedded these arguments in a normative context to give them more force and legitimacy. The context was entirely driven from the EU's own liberal norms. And so in a nutshell, the normative argument was the EU is a liberal community of states with an inclusionary, meritocratic enlargement discourse. It is open to outside members contingent on their liberalization. And since Turkey is in the process of fulfilling the Copenhagen criteria, particularly the political criteria, as acknowledged by the Commission itself before the Brussels summit, the EU should reward all this, and so that means it should not be exclusionary vis-a-vis Turkey. But despite all this rhetorical argumentation on the part of the Turkish actors, the rhetorical action, it did not work, because the EU decided on completely opposite terms than the ones favored by the Turkish government. So the question is, why did the rhetorical strategy not work? Why weren't Turkish politicians able to, quote, entrap the EU in its own liberal discourse before the Brussels summit? I argue that the answer has to do with EU member states' policy preferences regarding Turkey's membership. So basically, in Brussels, member states followed their own preferences as opposed to, say, following the EU's inclusionary community discourse on enlargement. And the preferences were very much fed by the anticipated costs of Turkey's accession in both material slash financial and arguably also identity terms. So to analyze the argument in depth, I started by demonstrating the presence of the EU's liberal rhetoric, which provided the normative basis of Turkish arguments. And then I, of course, looked at Turkish arguments themselves, and then finally the arguments on the side of the EU that were being developed in response to what Turkish actors were saying. So now I can fill you in on the details. Let me first start with the strategy of rhetorical action, or rhetorical entrapment, the strategy of rhetorical entrapment, because that is the one theoretical assumption against which I build the analysis. Now, as you may already know, the notion of rhetorical entrapment as a strategy, it was first developed by Frank Schimmelpfennig in a 2001 seminal article, which was published in an international organization. And there, Schimmelpfennig explained this strategy as the strategic use of norm-based arguments. So that's how the strategy of rhetorical entrapment was defined. And he applied this to the case of the EU's eastern enlargement. Basically, this is the argument. The EU decided to enlarge to the east because it was normatively entrapped to do so by the representatives of Central and Eastern European EU candidates. So these representatives, they constructed arguments based on the EU's liberal ideology, and they argued that they were fulfilling the EU's membership criteria, the liberal criteria. And so on that basis, if the EU is as liberal as it says it is, it should honor its liberal commitments to these countries and decide to enlarge, because doing otherwise would not be legitimate. And so you can see why this is entrapment, because they were trying to demonstrate to the EU that enlarging is demanded by its own liberal norms under these circumstances. So, when we look at Turkey, we see that a strategy which was very similar to this was used by Turkish political actors. The one distinction, perhaps, was that the arguments were used so much more extensively and systematically, given all the controversy in Europe about Turkey's EU membership. And in fact, we can, you know, we can go back in time and trace all these arguments to the times of the Helsinki summit back in December 1999, which first acknowledged Turkey's EU candidacy. But I'm not going to go that far, because really the controversy about Turkey's membership negotiations gained, somewhat of an official ground after the EU's December 2002 Copenhagen summit meeting. Because there, the possibility of membership negotiations first emerged for Turkey, officially speaking. The decision was, quote, if the European Council in December 2004, on the basis of a report and a recommendation from the Commission, decides that Turkey fulfills the Copenhagen political criteria, the European Union will open accession negotiations with Turkey without delay. So here comes the promise of launching membership negotiations. So I focus my analysis of Turkish arguments after that decision, because that's when the arguments were made heavily. Starting with December 2002 up until the time when the Brussels summit was held in December 2004, so many arguments were made in Turkey. It cut across political positions, if you will, you know, on the left or right of the political spectrum, didn't matter. Actors still voiced similar arguments, didn't matter if they were in opposition or in government. Following Schimmelpfennig's original work, I analyzed these arguments in three categories. The first was arguments focused on liberal European identity. The second is arguments focused on the Copenhagen membership criteria. And the third is arguments intended to expose the EU's inconsistencies in handling Turkey's accession process. Now, I won't go into the details of each arguments, but the one thing I will say is that it is possible to unite all these arguments around a single liberal normative core, okay? Because they were all constructed around the EU's liberal norms, all three types of arguments. And so the Turkish actors made an effort to present these arguments so that they would capture fundamental EU norms, maximizing the chances of entrapment and obviously also the chances of gaining favorable terms in Brussels. So, for example, the norm of unity in diversity was a key reference point. It was used a lot when arguing that the EU shouldn't be a Christian club, but a union of shared values and harmony of civilizations. Well, another one reference was made to the EU's quote responsibility and quote commitments vis-a-vis Turkey, following from Turkey's fulfillment of the political criteria, especially after this was recognized by the European Commission in fall 2004. One other frame of reference consisted of what the EU was not doing, that is to say, its deviation from its past normative commitments, as we can see in the gap between norms and practice. So here, the core argument was that the EU was discriminating against Turkey by debating options that hadn't been considered for the other EU candidates before. Things like privileged partnership, for instance, or permanent safeguard clauses and the like. This was unfair and even against EU law, so the argument went. Yet, despite this heavy normative rhetoric, as I told you earlier, there's no entrapment on the EU side, based on Turkey's sufficient compliance with the political criteria and as promised back in Copenhagen in December 2002, the EU opens negotiations, but it does not accommodate Turkey's other demands concerning accession itself. These were demands like a clear promise of membership, which would exclude anything short of that. So any allusion to the idea of privileged partnership, if you will, and obviously also, you know, no special membership criteria, as I told you earlier, that hadn't been imposed on the other candidates before. So all of this, well, the opposite of Turkey's expectations happened, and all of this is written in the framework for negotiations, which is part of the Brussels Council conclusions. It's paragraph 23. And if you read this framework as a whole, you see that, well, the tone is more exclusionary than inclusionary, regardless of the decision to launch negotiations. You see, it's really exclusionary rhetoric involved there. I had to look at the reasons why. Why was this happening? And my answer is that it was the policy preferences regarding Turkey's membership, and the preferences again reflected the fear of all the costs that Turkey's integration would inflict on the EU. As evidence, I basically followed all the debates leading up to the Brussels decision in the media. And my hunch was confirmed that the costly implications of Turkey's membership were widely discussed in the period which led up to the Brussels summit. And these also set the tone of deliberations in Brussels. And you can see there were two sets of costs which were widely debated. The material/financial costs and even the identity issue arising from Turkey's eventual EU membership. And the material costs were very much in line with the Commission's assessment. The Commission came up with a paper in October 2004, which precisely analyzed, you know, in very detail the implications of Turkey's membership, and it was entitled Issues Arising from Turkey's Membership. So the concerns, the arguments on this aspect very much mirrored the Commission's technical assessments, which appeared in October 2004. And there were two things, especially two things, were touched upon heavily, One was the fear of further Turkish immigration. So we're back to the immigration debate. Further Turkish immigration and its implications for the EU's labor markets. It's a very, very important, highly salient issue. And also Turkey's anticipated high share from the EU's funds, you know, structural cohesion funds, agricultural subsidies, and all of that. So this was a heavy focus of the debate. But there were also issues, as I mentioned, there was also concerns related to the identity aspect. And you can guess where those arguments were coming from, especially, well, on the right wing, let's say, and especially, you know, pro-integrationist and Christian democratic forces. But the, well, this the interesting thing is that it wasn't always limited to these forces, because even within the commission, you could come across certain parallel concerns. For instance, in the fall 2004, there's debate. And the one thing that, well, this one quote always struck me as very interesting. I can't remember the exact day, but it's during the fall of 2004. And it was made by the Dutch European Commissioner of the time, Frits Bolkestein. And he warned, quote, of the Islamization of Europe as a result of Turkey's accession. And he argued that if Turkey enters the EU, quote, the relief of Vienna in 1683 will have been in vain. So, very striking quote indeed. And the day after the Brussels decision is taken, the 18th of December 2004, you have the Commission President Barroso, who came stepped in and said Turkey has to win over the hearts and minds of skeptical Europeans by showing commitment to European values. So clearly the identity issue was also on the minds of these people. It wasn't just about the material aspects of Turkey's accession. And the one thing that I think the one conclusion, theoretically speaking, that we can take from all this is that what happened in Brussels runs against the expectations of sociological approaches and the rhetorical entrapments, narrowly put, because the discourse is more exclusionary and it reflects concerns about, you know, it's more interest-based, if you will, than anything else. And we can see this in the negotiation terms that are very tough indeed. But at the end of the day, we're also confronted with a very interesting question, which I think we should discuss when we get to the Q&A, and that is the fact that, the EU still opened accession negotiations with Turkey, right? So how do we explain that? If the EU is so vehemently opposed to Turkey's accession, based upon all the concerns about costs, so why open the negotiations? So anyhow, I have a quick answer to that, and I think there we could consider that the rhetorical entrapment thing may have worked to some extent, but I guess there was also a lot of room for bargaining, because when you look at how the decision was taken in Brussels, you have Austria, for instance, which agrees at the last minute to the opening of talks only after certain clauses were agreed upon, things like the open-endedness of negotiations and the like. So, you know, bargaining was still a very important dynamic there, which influenced the decision. And I'd like to leave with that.
Thank you very much, Bekan.